Hello, everybody. Would you kindly find a place to sit if you can? We'll get the show on the road. Where's our hero? There he is. Welcome, everybody, to the second William Dean Esquire book party. This could be habit forming. I must confess, as a political junkie, to being a bit groggy at this moment, including spending a good part of the afternoon listening to the most interesting Obama press conference. But that's another subject for another day. And it's very good to be here at this celebration and to see you all. I work for a book venture that is totally committed to the principles that, that editors are essential, that designers are essential, that publishers are essential, that distribution systems are essential, that media and bookstores are essential, not only to the publishing industry, but to the culture. Nonetheless, I cannot help being in awe of Bill Dean's operation, which is a one-man show. He does everything all by himself, including distribution and rave reviewing. And of course, violates all the principles, I believe. So, anyway, three cheers for Bill. And I just want to point out, we were just talking, the first Bill book party was in a private flat. This second book party is in this great library. So tomorrow, the world. And yeah, so with admiration for Bill's, for his longtime life of good works and for his new life as a literary tycoon, I salute my wonderful friend, Bill. Thank you, Joe.
Actually, writing your own reviews is in a great American literary tradition, because Walt Whitman did it all the time. And so I follow in his footsteps. My new book is called Into Distant Countries, Travels and Personal Journeys. In his life of Johnson, Boswell wrote of Johnson that he talked with uncommon animation of traveling into distant countries, that the mind was enlarged by it. And when I came across those words, into distant countries, I thought that is the title of my book. It is so poetic. And it also means a lot to me because Johnson means a lot to me. And I see my classmate, John Raboul, here. John and I were classmates at Harvard together. And we took Walter Jackson Bates' wonderful course, Johnson and His Circle. And when my mother asked me, what would you like for your graduation present, I said, The Achievement of Samuel Johnson by Walter Jackson Bate, so that these words are not only poetic, but they really resonate with me in terms of my past. Now, despite writing these beautiful words about traveling, Johnson was an infrequent traveler. He went on a walking tour with Boswell in the Hebrides, and he went to Paris with his dear friends, the Thrales, at the age of 66. He longed to go to Italy, and he once wrote, "A man who has not been in Italy is always conscious of an inferiority." I think that is such a beautiful line. A man who has not been in Italy is always conscious of an inferiority. And I think every single one of us who have been in Italy would be in total agreement with that statement. But it was not to be. He went on no further trips. Samuel Johnson was an infrequent traveler. At first, I was a reluctant traveler. My mother and sister Eleanor often went on trips abroad, and I was given the opportunity to go, but I so preferred being a counselor in Maine that I rejected all efforts to get me to travel. But in 1959, the year that I graduated from college, my mother said, I'm going to India to teach American foreign policy for the Ford Foundation in New Delhi, and why don't you come with me and we will go through the Far East together? That I could not refuse. And that was my introduction to India, my introduction to Asia, my introduction to the world. The next year, my mother said, I'm going on a fact-finding. This was a rather unusual mother, by the way, that I had. My mother's field was international relations. The next year, my mother said, I'm going on a fact-finding trip to West and East Africa. Would you like to come along with me? This was in 1960. The Senghor had just become president of Senegal. Sékou Touré had thrown the French out of Guinea. Oufuette Boigny was in Ivory Coast. Nkrumah had just become president of Ghana. We then went to the Congo. The Belgians were still there. The English were still in Tanganyika, Uganda, and Kenya. A further introduction to the world. At this point, I had become totally addicted to travel and have never refused an opportunity to travel. It is one of the joys of my life, as I know it for many of you here, it is one of the joys of your life. So part one of my book is really travel essays that I've written over the years. Part two is the subtitle of my book is Travels and Personal Journeys. Part two are personal journeys. These are travel essays of a metaphoric nature, not actual trips, but personal journeys into other worlds. The world of literature, the time I've spent with Montaigne and Chekhov, Tolstoy, Dickens, and Whitman. The world of opera, the wonderful times that I've spent with Puccini, Verdi, and Wagner. Of social justice, in terms of my participation professionally and as a volunteer with poor people and homeless and prisoners. And the world of teaching, because my first job coming out of Columbia Law School, I was the only person. Most of my classmates went to Davis Polk, and Sullivan and Cromwell, and Cravath. I went to Puerto Rico to start up an elementary school. This was pre-Peace Corps, my own invention. And I had a wonderful time teaching fourth through eighth graders in Puerto Rico. And when I finished 25 years at Volunteers of Legal Service, my first job was going to India, to Rajasthan, to teach 7th, 8th, and 9th graders English literature and public speaking. So teaching has been a very important part of my life. Thoreau, like Johnson, traveled very little. But when he was in New York on his very infrequent visits, he often came to the New York Society Library, where he had a very good relationship with the librarian. But he was hostile to foreign travel, and Thoreau wrote, it is not worthwhile to go around the world to count the cats in Zanzibar. But Thoreau reverenced the title of traveler, writing, his profession is the best symbol of our life. As we journey from life's start to life's conclusion, it is the history of every one of us. We are all travelers. Now I'm going to turn to a dear friend who, with me, traveled to Russia in 1993, and together we traveled in Russia on a bicycle. Nibet Habashi.
When Bill very kindly and generously asked me to speak tonight, I thought to myself, I have been privileged to travel with Bill Dean, or William Johnson Dean. And William Johnson Dean took as his model Samuel Johnson. No relation, I believe, Bill, right? And I thought to myself, as a peroration, wouldn't it have been fun for Samuel Johnson to travel with Bill Dean and learn a tremendous amount from Bill Dean? Because, like Samuel Johnson, Bill Dean loves to travel. He is endlessly curious, and he can give you a wonderful time on any journey. That has been my good fortune. But Samuel Johnson would have had to make some accommodation to Bill Dean. For one thing, he would have had to give up his aisle seat on the aeroplane, as well as give up the longer bed in whatever inn or establishment they wound up in. He'd have had to listen to Bill warbling Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hammerstein something less than well. He'd have had to live with Bill's penchant for elderly luggage, a sports sack that has had a very long life. He'd have had to read Bill's articles for the Christian Science Monitor, and he would have had to like McDonald's milkshakes. The Thrales and James Boswell, who traveled with Samuel Johnson, no doubt enlarged their minds, even as I had the privilege of doing. William Johnson Dean does something Samuel Johnson could have never fathomed, of course, and that is travel by bicycle. We have been to several places besides Russia, mind you, perhaps less distant in some cases, through Central Park on New Year's Eve, Hyde Park to contemplate Mr. Roosevelt, Valkill to contemplate Mrs. Roosevelt, the Vanderbilts, Midwood in New York State, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania on the July 4th weekend itself, 150 years almost to the day after that fateful Civil War battle, and of course the golden Kremlin city-states of Russia. It is this last that perhaps you will allow me to remember fondly. William Johnson Dean taught several Russians and one Egyptian a great deal about Russia. Here are some of the bits perhaps not in Bill's memoir, Into Distant Countries. We actually arrived at Zagorsk by bike. Zagorsk today is called Sergei Posad, its old name in another Russia. And to arrive at that town with the blue cupolas, with the gold stars, pedaling ourselves along the streets, was something I'll never forget. Winding up completely by accident on the eve of the Feast of the Assumption was one of the glories of our journey. And then to go through St. Petersburg, to go up and down the Nevsky Prospect on a bicycle, stopping off to buy caviar, which was later confiscated by the customs agent. To go to the Mariinsky Theater. We did not go by bicycle that night, but we did cycle all over St. Petersburg and indeed towards the Hermitage and took in all the sights. There was so much that happened with people because we were on bicycles. That visit to Vera that you'll read about in the book. We had no language to speak of between Bill and myself. We could muster a little bit sometimes in French with folks, but by and large, we were fairly helpless with language. But Vera, you didn't need language. There was a Chekhov play on television that night. And every time that Vera went by the television, she simply touched her heart and said, "Heart, heart." And it was crystal clear what she meant. I mean, we had a dialogue after 3 days, and as Bill tells us in the book, we all wept when we went away. Now, perhaps some of the bond was that we had arrived in this rather singular fashion with our bicycles, but there definitely was something special about this particular trip. And then, of course, there were the rather simple things that we all had to deal with. Trying to take a bath in a teapot became a sport because hot water was at a premium. And so I think in one instance, Bill, you were given a bucket, and I was given the teapot from dinner, and I remember looking at the teapot and thinking, now let's see, how am I going to parcel out just enough for my person, and then how am I going to have enough for all of me, and possibly a little bit of laundry. I mean, there were things that we had to think about because we were on a very tight budget with everybody, and these things were all very special. But most of all, Bill found himself having to teach our guides a great deal about their homeland. Oh yes, Sasha had read War and Peace 5 times, but he'd never laid eyes on the New Testament, much less the Old Testament. And so one of my favorite moments was walking through a magnificent cathedral and looking at the frescoes, and there was Christ entering Jerusalem on a donkey. And I idly pointed out that, oh, look, there's Christ coming in on a donkey. And Sasha, one of our guides, said, "It's not donkey, it's horse." And I said, no, you don't understand, Sasha. You see, Christ came in all humility on a donkey. That's a donkey. He looked at it again and said, "It's not donkey, it's horse." Anyway, this went on for quite a while, Sasha being absolutely unable to really take in the whole point of it. And so Bill did Bible 101 and had to keep doing it in almost every church we ever went into. And then, of course, there were the basics of the whole panoply of the Romanov dynasty, Boris Godunov, the opera, and indeed going to the Mariinsky with our hosts, who earlier in the day, the pater familias, had to go and collect potatoes. He was, by the way, a physicist, but in order to have enough for the winter, he was collecting potatoes on the side. The experiences were very, very many. I must say, my mind was, I think, enlarged. I thank Bill enormously for that. I thank Russia for giving us one of the most glorious journeys one could ever hope to have. And I am so proud that I am part of Bill's life in a small way, page 96. And and have loved all of it. And thank you, Bill, and thank you all for your attention to all of this. It was very, very special indeed. Congratulations, Bill.
Nemet is much too modest. Nemet is extraordinarily talented when it comes to languages. And after about 7 days, she was coming out with sentences in Russian. I do want to just mention one thing, because we were in 1993, the Soviet Union, I guess it had collapsed at that point, but in 1993, our guides, we were the first people that these three young men were showing around Russia. Our guides had up to that point been working on nuclear submarines in the Lenin shipyard in Gorky. And they saw there was no future in nuclear submarines. So they decided to go into the travel business knowing nothing about anything. They stole a van from the Lenin shipyards, which is how we traveled around in Russia. They were the three absolutely wonderful human beings, and we had tremendous fun with them. Now, I am going to call on one other traveler, and namely Henry S.F. Cooper, Jr. Come on up here, Henry. And Henry and I spent some time together in Venice. And Henry's going to talk a little bit about it. I guess I should move.
True, we did spend some time in Venice, and I will tell you about it. Now, let me see. Right. Bill Dean loves travel. We know that. He particularly loves to travel to Venice. Not only that, he loves to talk about his travels or write about them, particularly when they take him to Venice. He thinks that Venice is the most beautiful, the most civilized place in the world. About 10 years ago, I happened to be in Italy, and I arranged to visit him in his favorite city. More than that, I challenged him to show me what was so special about Venice, to show me his Venice, to convince me that this was indeed the most marvelous city in the world. He was, after all, on his 17th visit to the place. There must be something that kept bringing him back. Bill was staying in the Pensione Seguso, right on the Giudecca Canal, about a 15-minute walk from San Marco. About 50 years ago, it had been recommended to Bill's mother, Bernard Berenson, whom she had been staying with. Bill recommended it to me, but he was staying there himself, so I joined him there. It turned out to be a little like Fawlty Towers. The toilet in my bedroom was the old-fashioned variety with a water tank high overhead. When I pulled the chain, the tank came loose, and if it hadn't gotten wedged in against the wall, it would have come crashing down on my head. This was not the most auspicious start to a visit to the most wonderful city in the world. I joined Bill for tea on the terrace in front of the hotel. He had, it turned out, taken my challenge very seriously, and he had spent several days deciding exactly what he would show me that would prove to me that Venice was indeed the most wonderful place. He had worked on the problem steadily over the last several days, and I must say that he had come up with a brilliant answer. Over tea, he laid out his plan. The next morning after breakfast, we crossed the long, narrow island to the Grand Canal on the other side and visited a compact little museum, the Academia, or the Academia, I don't know which.
Academia,
which was filled with a chronology of Venetian art. I had not realized how many Italian artists were, in fact, Venetian artists. Bernini, Titian, Tintoretto, and all the rest. Bill was especially concerned with familiarizing me with the artists' different styles, so that if I ever saw another painting by the same artist, I would know who the painter was. This, it turned out, was the whole point of his taking me through the museum. Bill pointed out the iconography of the art. He accused me of being a dumb student, unable to keep track of such things as who was the baby with the halo, who was the guy with the arrow sticking out of him. But you must not believe a word of that. Just as museumitis was setting in, we left the Academia and had espresso on the terrace outside and then set out on a walk through Venice, going from one square to another, almost always finding a church crammed with paintings. Inside church after church, Bill would get me to identify one artist after another, almost always recognizable from the works we had seen at the Academia. I did occasionally get the people with the halos mixed up, but by and large, I did very well. Outside, Bill would point out domes or towers in the distance. I was usually able to identify them from the Canaletto's and other cityscape painters that Bill had shown me at the museum. Now, Bill told me, I would never get lost in Venice because I knew so many landmarks. Our walk through Venice went on for 3 days. The remainder of my visit, I got to know Venice and its artists very well. I must say, I cannot think of a better, more imaginative way of showing a friend a city. Thank you, Bill, for showing me your Venice. It is indeed a marvelous place.
And stay with me. So let me just conclude by I've had a 40-year deep involvement with the New York Society Library. And so Barbara and Mark, thank you for letting us come here and have this event here. And it could not be a greater, more wonderful venue. And I wanted Henry to remain with me because Henry was the chairman of the board when I came here, and I was his successor. So you're seeing 150 years of board membership. So enjoy yourselves. We have wonderful food and things to drink, and please buy books.